Good evening. I'm Terry Wilson. I'm the head of the Fine Arts Library, and I'd like to welcome you to our event this evening in the History of Art Faculty New Publication Series. Tonight, we're hearing from John Fry, who is an associate professor in the Department of Art, Art History and Design, and the Department of Romance and Classical Studies. John's recent publication, and I'm sorry I have to look at this here, is Spolia in Fortifications and the Common Builder in Late Antiquity, published by Brill. John is a field archaeologist who studies architectural reuse and digital archaeology, and I think we'll be hearing about some of the aspects of reuse this evening. So please join me in welcoming John Fry.
Thanks, Terry.
I asked Terry if she wouldn't just say, here's John, he's a kind of nice guy, but she had to do the formal. So tonight's talk is not so much about the book, but about other things that the book's been sort of making me think about. And I've written it all out so that we can kind of stay close to time here, so I don't keep you longer than you need to be here. If people are here because of an assignment or extra credit or anything like that, just guessing. All right. So let's go ahead and get started here. Until very recently, the reuse of architecture, or spoliation, had been considered, if at all, as merely another example of the decline of classical culture into the Middle Ages. This sentiment was expressed most clearly by our friend Vasari here, who in the preface to his collection of Renaissance artist biographies wrote the following. He said, "The arts declined steadily from day to day, until at length, by a gradual process, they entirely lost all perfection of design. Clear testimony to this is afforded by the works in sculpture and architecture produced in Rome in the time of Constantine, notably in the triumphal arch made for him by the Roman people at the Colosseum." So he's referring to the arch here that you see on your left. Where we see that for lack of good masters, not only did they make use of marble reliefs carved in the time of Trajan, but also of spoils, so he uses the word spolia or spoglia in Italian, but also of spoils brought to Rome from various places. Those who recognize the excellence of these bas-reliefs, statues, the columns, the cornices, and other ornaments which belong to another era will perceive how rude are the proportions done to fill up gaps by sculptors of the day. Very rude also are some scenes of small figures in marble below the reliefs in the pediment, representing victories, while between the side arches there are some rivers, also very crude, and so poor that they leave one firmly under the impression that the art of sculpture had begun to decline even before the coming of the Goths and other barbarous and foreign nations who combined to destroy all the superior arts as well as Italy. So this cursory and decidedly negative assessment of reuse practices continued to hold sway until the mid-20th century when, inspired by the artistic trends of their own time that challenged the classical realism as the height of artistic achievement, scholars like Friedrich Wilhelm Deichmann, Arnold Esch, and Richard Krautheimer began to study examples of reuse in a more systematic fashion. Now, in their wake, a small group of archaeologists and architectural historians have grappled with the possible causes and meanings behind this phenomenon to the point that spolia studies might well be considered a scholarly category in its own right now. And as with any nascent field of study, the examination of spoliation is marked by such a diversity of approaches that it's possible to define its boundaries and contours only in the most general terms. So the image I show you here was a landmark work in the 1940s, well, in 1940 actually, where Friedrich Wilhelm Deichmann pointed out that the reuse of architecture, specifically columns, was not sort of just a chaotic stopgap measure, but they actually followed a systematic organizational scheme depending on the ground plan of individual basilicas and churches. To begin with, nearly all who have addressed the matter have pointed out that examples of architectural reuse can be found throughout the ancient world, and that at a basic level, the time and effort saved by recycling, as opposed to quarrying new blocks, is a likely explanation. Yet many scholars have gone on to suggest that beginning with the monuments of the later Roman period, such as the aforementioned Arch of Constantine and a number of early Christian churches, the source of spolia and the unique manner of its reuse indicates that the practice came to serve other functions as well. Deichmann often detected a hint of religious triumphalism in the incorporation of identifiably pagan artifacts into the walls and floors of Christian churches. Some scholars, such as Beat Brank and Hugo Brandenburg, have pointed out that the patchwork appearance of buildings built with spolia fits well with an aesthetic principle of a variety, or varietas, that was popular at the time. For Josh Elsner and Philip Pierce, examples of reuse represent an appropriation of architectural relics, and more importantly, the political or religious power they were thought to carry. Now, in my own research, I've worked to challenge some of the basic assumptions that have formed the foundations of reuse studies up to the present. Thus, in a recent article, I've argued that the colonnade that you see here on the sort of stretching out on the right-hand side of the picture on the top there, I've argued that a colonnade built in the first century AD, that is during the reign of the family of the Emperor Augustus, built from the remains of a 6th century BC temple in Corinth, this was a powerful symbol of Roman dominance that should challenge our notions of reuse as a sign of cultural and artistic decline. Now, in my book, I focus on the reuse of materials in the construction of defensive walls. I use this as a demonstration not only of the neglect of fortifications as evidence in studies of ancient architecture in general, but also of the dangers of assuming a typological approach to the study of spoliation. As I've argued, things reused in a meaningful way, that's often when scholars are forced to define what exactly is spolia, they'll say, well, spolia is stuff reused in a meaningful way as opposed to things that are just sort of reused because they were convenient and or laying around. So as I've argued, things reused in a meaningful way is not effective as a category of study, not only because it relies on anachronistic notions of perception and reception, but also because it treats the way something was used as an objective trait that can somehow be determined in each instance, even when something has been removed from its context. So for example, were I to take the column drums out of that wall and set them next to a column drum that was not reused in a bit of architecture somewhere later in time, you'd be hard-pressed to know exactly which one was the spolia and which one wasn't. So this idea of things being reused meaningfully doesn't really sort of cut it when we're talking about spoliation. Instead, I've suggested that we focus on spolia not as objects to be identified according to their original use and in isolation from their architectural context, but as valuable evidence in the study of building practices more generally. In this way, the incongruity of reused material that makes it so recognizable to us can be used to greatest effect in revealing the day-to-day decisions, and perhaps even perceptions, of the masons and builders who were charged with the task of erecting buildings out of remnants of the classical past. So we're kind of getting on to what I'd like to talk about today. Reused inscriptions have proved particularly useful in pursuing this research, but they are also characterized by unique problems of their own. To begin with, the privileged place of texts in our study of the ancient world has meant that the mere presence of Greek or Latin often led to the removal of blocks from a building or monument for further study. Often these things were removed without proper documentation of their archaeological context, so now we have to study them in museums and wonder about where exactly they were in their primary and secondary point of use. Even for those inscriptions that have remained in their place of secondary use, the letters carved into a stone often encourages us to take a second look, to question whether the message they contain might have played a role in determining the manner of their reuse. Now, on the one hand, we have to entertain the possibility that these inscriptions were essentially meaningless, that they functioned only as ready-made blocks that could be used in structurally important locations like doorways, windows, and corners. In his study of spolia in medieval England, Tim Eaton has noted that the inscriptions discovered in the walls and foundations of churches over the last 4 centuries have been far more frequently placed face in, that is, rendering them unrecognizable as inscriptions, so they would have looked just like any other block. Robert Coates Stevens has observed a similar situation in Rome, pointing out that the large number of inscriptions that are now displayed as museum pieces in the walls of medieval churches were originally used face down as paving slabs on the floors. Now, on the other hand, scholars such as Helen Saradi have argued the consistent appearance of inscribed and sculpted materials in the same locations on Byzantine churches would seem to suggest that their appearance did hold meaning for the builders and patrons at certain places and points in time. Amy Papalexandro has convincingly shown through her study of the Church of the Virgin of Skripu in Boeotia that in some cases, the elite patrons who were ultimately responsible for these projects could read these texts, and the decision to include them in the walls of their church shows their esteem for a period and place with which they wish to associate themselves. In another important contribution to the discussion, Dale Kinney has demonstrated that it was not always necessary that the inscription could be read correctly. Her analysis of an inscribed column in the Church of Santa Maria in Rome suggests that a misreading of the inscription allowed Christians to generate a local history that connected this church to the Emperor Augustus, who was emperor at the time of the birth of Christ. What is more, even if the average viewer could not read these ancient texts, the recognition of a single word or a single phrase could evoke meaningful associations. In the words of Papa Alexandru, a commonality with the past would be immediately forged through the visual appearance of a language or script. This could have reinforced the sense that the past before my eyes is my own. These interpretations of inscribed spolia clearly cover a wide spectrum of possibilities. And there's no reason why any one of them should be considered more correct than the others. My goal today, rather, is to suggest yet another possible reading, or perhaps I should say, non-reading of these inscriptions. I've started to wonder, could it ever have been the case that inscriptions were incorporated in these structures simply because of the appearance, or their appearance, or their symbolic meaning, and not necessarily because they were meant to be read, they were meant to be interpreted, or understood? Or does the mere presence of the written word in an inscription always demand of its viewer an attempt at literal comprehension? Now, the 14th century church of Agios Yorgos in Ekrefnia, that's in Boeotia, serves as an excellent case study in point. The appearance of this church has changed a great deal due to the addition of a narthex, an exonarthex, and a number of additional external buttresses. But the use of spolia, including a number of inscribed blocks, has remained a consistent feature throughout. So, which one I'm supposed to point at. Maybe I'll run back and forth between the two. So we have the original church here, which was actually given a narthex and then eventually an exonarthex. And then we also have the addition of these buttress walls. But we can still find individual pieces of spolia sort of situated inside the walls. And I'll show you a couple of them now. Many of the inscriptions caught the eye of early modern travelers and antiquarians, whose century-old publications remain the only discussion of this church. Unfortunately, their interest in content over context, as well as later modifications to the church, leaves us to guess at the location of many of these inscriptions. But three examples that can be identified today are worthy of further consideration. All three concern the deeds of a certain individual, an Epaminondas of Ekrefnia. Now, you can see it's sort of second stone up from the bottom, the one sort of horizontally positioned just above the grass level. One inscription that's been inserted sideways into the southeastern corner of the church at ground level honors him for leading a legation of Boeotians to the Roman Emperor and for sponsoring the revival of the Ptolemaic Games at Ekrefnia. Another inscription, located sideways along the north wall of the church at ground level, records Nero's proclamation of freedom of the Greeks, followed by Epaminondas's report of a citizen's decision to erect statues of Nero, Zeus liberator. We're talking about this inscription located down here. The last inscription, a copy of several letters from the Roman emperor honoring Epaminondas, is now located right side up along the eastern side of the north doorway to the narthex. This is a particularly interesting one, for while it's clearly no longer part of the original church construction, the large cutting into the face of the inscription shows that it was once positioned upside down and was intended to receive a bar to secure a closed door. As such, it's quite possible that this block, now in its third phase of use, once served as one of the jambs of the main entrance into the original church, which at the time of the addition of the narthex was moved to its present location. To try and make sense of this, there would be a corresponding hole in the block that you see right here, and you would have put a metal bar into that hole and then slid it down the groove where it drops into place right there and can seal a door from opening out this way. Now, in its current position, it doesn't make any sense because when you put the bar in place, it simply falls out and the door can be opened. So we have to assume that this was actually the other way around. The inscription currently is right side up. But if we flip it over, it makes the inscription upside down, but makes the block actually functional as a way to bar the door. Now, it's easy to see how all the above-mentioned interpretations could apply to this church. First of all, it's quite possible that these inscribed blocks were simply seen as useful building material. As such, the similar date and context of inscriptions may indicate that they had originally stood in close proximity to one another and were transported as a group to the site of the church. However, the reuse of these inscriptions in locations that mimic the placement of decorative spolia in other churches in other parts of Greece suggests that the words they contain may have been considered significant. In this regard, it's important to mention that in the inscription, that in the one inscription, most, but not all instances of Nero's name have been scratched out. That's a particularly interesting detail, right? While it's likely that these alterations took place soon after he was declared an enemy of the Roman state, it's possible that Nero's notoriety as a Christian persecutor required that these references to his name be removed when the block became reused in a Christian context. Such an interpretation would certainly require a relatively careful reading of the text on the part of the Byzantine builders. They would have had to have gone through a fairly complex inscription, found all examples of Nero's name, and then chiseled them out very carefully. Finally, the repeated mention of the name Akrefnia, which certainly would have been recognizable to the Byzantine Akrefnians, the repeated mention of that name and one of its most prominent citizens in antiquity might have been seen as a significant link between Byzantine builders and a more illustrious classical past. However, there's a problem with this last interpretation. We know from the text, and this is the only copy we have of the text, I keep trying to go up to Boeotia to find the church open. I can't figure out who has the key. And sometimes it's open, sometimes it's not. The last time it was open, it was under archaeological research, and I wasn't allowed to take photographs. So this is the only example I have of the inscription that's painted above one of the windows inside the church. We know from the text painted above the window on the south wall inside the church that this building was dedicated in 1311 by an Antoine Le Flamenc, who had been appointed to the post of local administrator in 1303, and who was one of only a few Frankish knights to have survived the disastrous Battle of Kephissos in March of 1311. So we're in the time here of the Fourth Crusade. So at the beginning of the 13th century, we have a number of crusaders that come down through Greece on their way to the Holy Land in order to free Constantinople and to free the areas of Jerusalem and places that have come under Muslim control. And for reasons that are clear only to them, they decide to pull up short and conquer the Christian nation state of Greece instead and establish a Frankish kingdom in Greece. And so this Antoine Le Flamenc is part of this process. So he's a French Christian knight who's taking control of Byzantine Christian territory and is now controlling it. While the dedication does not cite a reason, William Miller long ago speculated that this church was built in fulfillment of a vow that Antoine Le Flamenc made just before the Battle of Kephissos. Now, Kephissos ends up being a very, very disastrous battle for the Franks. They end up losing to a number of mercenaries in the Catalan Company. And while I suppose one could imagine a situation where through a careful choice of ancient inscriptions, our patron is drawing a meaningful connection between himself and other foreign rulers who freed the Greeks and honored their prominent citizens, I doubt that this is somehow the case. For even though he was described in the Livre de la Conquête as one of the smartest men in Romania, I suppose that's a claim to fame, it seems unlikely that this Frankish knight born in the Holy Land and recently come to Thessaly, okay, would have had time for such antiquarian pursuits, especially considering the fact that he had just lost control of the region that he was supposed to be in charge of. He had just lost control to it, to the mercenaries, control of it to the mercenaries of the Catalan Company. All this has led me to wonder if there's not another option. Has it ever been the case, either in the use of spolia, or in the in architecture in general, that the mere appearance of words was considered visually pleasing or symbolic, even if they could not be read? Part of the problem in answering such a question for the ancient world concerns the incomplete nature of our evidence. Very few of the monuments that have survived until today come with any type of supplementary information. We rarely know the name of the patron or the builders, much less the intended goals or public reception of the projects. Thus, in seeking an answer to this question, I've turned to a relatively, maybe very, non-traditional direction and started to look at the work of contemporary artists. At the very least for you guys, it's going to be far more interesting than staring at these things all day, which is usually what I do. And while I fully recognize that any attempt to read the present onto the past is overly simplistic, at the same time I'm convinced that a study of roughly analogous examples about which we are much better informed can be of value in either confirming the validity of our interpretive schemes for the past or suggesting new avenues of interpretation altogether. So I'd like to briefly introduce the work of four contemporary artists that I found particularly useful in coming to a better understanding of the use of the written word in art and architecture. While his One in Three Chairs, essentially an artistic exploration of Platonic forms, is often held up as one of the canonical examples of conceptual art, Joseph Kossuth's larger body of academic and artistic work shows an ongoing concern with the role of written language. In 1991, Kossuth completed one of his more architectural pieces in Figeac, France, birthplace of Jean-François Champollion and home to the Champollion Museum. In the court of the Place de l'Écriture, Kossuth installed an enormous copy of the Rosetta Stone, the famous Ptolemaic-era inscription that Champollion used to decipher Egyptian hieroglyphs. As an accurate copy of the Rosetta Stone, this work contains words in three different languages. I find that an interesting parallel, right, with the tripartite works for which Kossuth is most famous. So his One in Three Chairs is perhaps mimicked in the One in Three Greek and hieroglyphic transcriptions. At the same time, though, it's likely the case that few people have actually read the hieroglyphs or the Greek, especially at such an enormous scale. Rather, the Rosetta Stone has become such an easily recognized object that the actual reading of its contents is no longer essential in order to appreciate its significance, and in this case, the symbolic meaning of its location. Move on to our second one. Anne Hamilton has been creating installation pieces for close to 35, 40 years now, many of which center on the spoken and written word and the ways in which we try and sometimes fail to communicate with one another. While several of her works could be of use in contemplating the aesthetic value of the written word, I'd like to concentrate on two pieces in particular. In 1996, as part of the renovation of the San Francisco Public Library, Hamilton worked with local artist Anne Chamberlain to create a 5,000 square foot mural using 50,000 3x5-inch index cards recycled from the librarian's cataloging system that was being phased out of use in exchange for an electronic system. A team of over 200 individuals was given the task of supplementing the information on each card with a quote or a drawing from the book that it referenced. These cards were then arranged over the surface of a three-story tall wall that served as a divider between the public reading space and the private stacks. Now, it's doubtful that one could ever reach, much less read, each individual part of the library's old system that was adhered to the walls. At the same time, though, patrons waiting for a book to be delivered to them have the opportunity to examine a small subset of the overall piece, where they will notice that, quote, cards bear signs of years of use, abraded surfaces, handwritten notes, bent corners, and have been written in any of a dozen different languages. Now, when viewed at a distance, the overall patchwork appearance of the piece is somewhat unremarkable. But when one recognizes and reads the subject of just one of the 50,000 parts of this work, the overall meaning of the piece is made instantly accessible. Patrons are challenged to consider the unique and intimate nature of each book in the library, as well as the old system by which people once located these works, perhaps evoking a sense of nostalgia while they await their electronically retrieved texts. Now, Hamilton's installation as the U.S. representative in the 1999 Venice Biennale is another impressive work that directly addresses the question of words as aesthetic objects or as bearers of meaning. A work she describes as more consciously made, more public labored piece, her work Mayen resulted from Hamilton's interest in exploring the contrast between the unspoken history of conflict and violence in America with the austere neoclassical setting of the United States Pavilion. While this installation involved a number of outside elements, so you can kind of see a little bit on the left there, Hamilton's creative use of the interior is of greatest relevance to us today. Here she covered the walls of each of the interconnected galleries with plastered dots that represented a Braille translation of Charles Reznikoff's testimony, The United States, 1885 to 1915. This work is a selection of court records that he had found and turned into poetic form. If you ever want a troubling read, look that up. It basically depicts a great deal of violent and sort of awful acts that people engage in with each other and had been brought up to sort of, you know, in trial format. Over the course of the exhibition, a fine pink powder was released from the ceiling. And as it cascaded down the walls and caught on the raised dots, the Braille words were slowly revealed. Meanwhile, an audio recording of Hamilton whispering Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address, but she does it letter by letter and in international phonetic code, this thing played in the background. And if perhaps, let me see, I'll give you another shot here of it as the piece sort of piles up over time. But if I can do this right, here's just a quick, that didn't work at all. Do I pull right or left to get it to come up? Oh, we're getting closer. All right. There we are. So just a quick shot of what some of this looks like. So you'll see the at a certain point here. So there's the copy of the text on the inside of what she's reading to you. You're passing to the outside of the pavilion. You can speed this up a bit. Wow, here. So we get the idea that over the course of the exhibition, right, the Braille dots slowly pick up the red dust, and they are theoretically readable at that point. But it's Braille, right? Okay. The overall effect of this installation was one of words that could be experienced, but never really understood. Hamilton's use of Braille is perhaps most interesting of all, for even when it had been revealed, the words of a system that allows one to read only through touch could still not be understood by the sighted or the blind. Were it not for the fact that Hamilton had printed the text of both the Reznikoff poem and the Lincoln speech on the walls of the entrance hall, the viewer would have been left to appreciate these words without being able to even grasp their meaning. Our next artist, although his work is perhaps more digital than architectural, the installations of Finnish artist Charles Sandison also offer insight into the potential use of words as art objects that function independently of their semantic sense. In essence, Sandison's work is all about words, little packets of text, the interactions of which with one another and with the architectural space onto which they're projected are determined by a computer code that he writes. On one level, the meaning of the words is important and often plays a role in determining their function. So for example, he will take a series of words that have been designated as masculine or feminine and how the words react with each other on the surface of the building according to whether or not they've been assigned certain traits, violent words versus peaceful words, these kind of things. Right, according to Sandison, he says, I try to build into the work different layers of reading. Each layer is interwoven across time and space. From a distance, the words are perceived as moving objects, but upon closer inspection, they are recognized as text. A particularly relevant example is Sandison's most recent installation at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. The work, entitled Figurehead, consists of over a dozen different animated computer projections of typewritten and handwritten words in different languages, as well as drawings that Sandison gathered from nautical logbooks and manifests in the museum's collection. The effect has been described as a phosphorescent sea in ceaseless motion, the individual parts of which can only be comprehended at brief intervals and with some effort. While the words that form the building blocks of Sandison's art are carefully chosen to relay messages that are relevant both to the overall work and its specific meaning, one does not need to grasp their meaning in order to appreciate the piece. Let me see if I can, it's kind of the stills don't necessarily do it justice, so hopefully I can drag another, if I could find the, all right, there we are. So you can see a lot of examples of his work, but this is perhaps the one of the more interesting ones. Now, if I could just figure out where I am. Are we close? Oh, look at that. There we are. Right, so this will just run for about a minute or so, but it's... So this is the sort of unprojected, right, interior that he's working with. I don't know. He's saying important things now. It's really something to see his work. I had the chance to see his work a few years ago in Athens, and it's interesting how much the audience kind of becomes part of the work as well, as the words are sort of written on them and everybody becomes sort of a collective part of the piece. But it's not, at the same time, it's not just sort of scattered meaning, or sort of just words thrown up that are following whatever code. You can see, right, there's Arabic there, and there's English, and there's cursive and print, and but each of the individual things are chosen to sort of behave in a certain way according to their content, as it were. Right. Perhaps most interesting of all is the work of Chinese contemporary artist Zhu Bing, whose Book from the Sky remains one of the most important and most discussed examples of Chinese New Wave art that followed the end of the Cultural Revolution. Now, this work was originally titled Mirror to Analyze the World, the Century's Final Volume, but it was actually renamed by his audience, Qianshu, a word that reflects the manner of its display and hints at its perceived supernatural character. This work is truly unique. In its most common form, it consists of books printed as bound volumes, scrolls, and big letter posters that use over 4,000 Chinese characters, designed and eventually carved into woodblock printing tiles by Zhu Bing over the course of 4 years between 1987 and 1991. He chose 4,000 characters, he says, because that's the minimum number of characters that's required to understand sort of, you know, common communication in print in contemporary China. Upon closer inspection, though, the traditional appearance and format of the work, of the words, gives way to a baffling fact. All 4,000 Chinese characters were specifically designed to have absolutely no meaning in the Chinese language. They are all his invention. The full impact of this work is most likely lost on a non-Chinese literate audience, myself included. But perhaps other works that Zhu Bing has created during the 2 decades that he spent in the US following the Tiananmen Square event, he's recently returned to China, right? Prior to his return to China, may help give us a sense. So for example, his 1992 work called Post Testament consists of calfskin bound books printed with metal type and titles in Gothic script with illuminated initials, thus giving them a feeling of traditional scholarly authority, right? They have the nice look of a early 20th century printed volume. Yet the content itself consists of the text of the King James Bible, alternated word by word with the text of a violent pulp fiction novel. The resulting effect is a confounding jumble of nonsense. You have to read every other word to get a sense of which one is about which. Okay, which is in contrast to the formal and traditional appearance of the overall piece. Now, his 1993 work, Braille Literate, featured a reading room full of copies of texts in Braille that were printed with intentionally mistaken titles on the cover. This had the effect of rendering the full meaning of the text unknowable. I suppose the full meaning of the work unknowable to the sighted community who could not read Braille, as well as the blind community who could not know the printed title. Now, Book from the Sky continues to fascinate and has been scrutinized in careful detail by scholars of the Chinese language, who incidentally have found 4 or 5 obscure Chinese characters that Zhu Bing accidentally reinvented, and widely discussed in the art world, but has received little explanation from Zhu Bing himself. Some have observed that as the child of academics, his father was head of a history department and his mother worked in the Department of Library Sciences, who were eventually deemed reactionaries and re-educated. And as one who served as a calligrapher in a propaganda office, Zhu Bing had a firsthand experience of the ways in which the meaning of words could be shifted and manipulated to political ends. Others have noted his deep appreciation for the written word. As a child, he collected examples of different fonts from newspapers and the distinction between form and content that nevertheless remain integrated within the Chinese writing system. Zhu Bing has simply commented that the beauty of this work suggests to the viewer that there is deeper meaning, and in attempting to read the characters, each individual is confounded and therefore forced to create their own experience. Now, admittedly, these examples are a far cry from a medieval church in Greece, but I think that in spite of the vast differences in historical and cultural setting, The detailed information we possess concerning these contemporary works of art, all of them, mind you, more or less architectural in nature, offers new insights into possible uses of the written word in a much earlier era. And based on these decidedly modern examples, I would argue that it is possible for words to be used in a work of art or architecture in a way that does not necessarily require the viewer to read them. In each artist's work, it is not the meaning of the words, but simply their appearance that creates the initial and arguably most lasting effect on the viewer. I cannot think of a single review of any of these projects that offers more than a brief mention of the texts that have been used. Rather, the focus is always on the manner of their use. For example, the way Hamilton's braille catches the red powder, or the way Sandison's projected words bump and cluster on the walls. I also suspect that for some viewers, recognition of the shape and size of the text in Jubing's books or Hamilton's index cards or the overall form of Kossuth's Rosetta Stone is enough to allow them to identify these objects and begin to form their own meaningful associations. Moreover, it's clear that one of the intended effects of these works is to make it difficult, or in some cases even possible, for the reader to view them or to read them. The use of languages such as braille, hieroglyphs, the placement of words in inaccessible locations, or the creation of illegible or constantly moving text are all mechanisms that these artists have employed in order to make it so that a literal understanding, a literal reading of the entire work is all but impossible. I don't think this is done to exclude the viewer, but rather to draw them in closer and to encourage them to linger on the piece. What is more, in many respects, these works benefit from their illegibility, for they ask the viewer to project upon the whole what they can only recognize in part. In this way, words become interchangeable objects that are representative of larger concepts than those which can be relayed in a literal reading of the text. The overall effect is to create an almost infinite variety of experiences within a larger conceptual framework. Another consistent characteristic of all these works is that they are firmly rooted in the particular circumstances of their setting, so that an understanding of the history of their location increases the impact of the piece upon the viewer. Kossuth's use of the Rosetta Stone is the clearest example, as it depends on knowledge of the history of the artifact's translation. Somewhat more abstractly, Sandison's confusing flow of information over the surface of the museum evokes the uncertain circumstances of nautical exploration that produce the objects that are stored within. Likewise, Hamilton's exploration of the bloody and violent history of American society is made even more poignant by the way her installation contrasts with the austere classical setting of the American Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. Many times, this location-specific information requires conversations with other viewers and an exchange of background information to come to a most full understanding of what these works are intended or could mean. Thus, the fact that these works frustrate us in our search for an easy explanation, in the end, serves to unite rather than isolate and distance viewers. So how might these later examples affect the way that we see the church at Akrefnia, or the use of inscriptions in spolia in general? I'd say that if we're willing to consider the possibility that the use of inscriptions in Byzantine Greece shares certain characteristics with contemporary works of art and architecture, then we may wish to focus our research in specific directions. For example, if it should be the case that, as with Hamilton's Maine or Sandison's figurehead, the inscription simply provided a visual stimulus that served to draw in the viewer and hold their attention, then we may want to look more closely at the ways in which spolia might have served as one part of a multi-sensory experience that is often the goal of installation art. Or perhaps it's the case that, like Hamilton's index cards, Byzantine builders saw inscriptions as unique, yet essentially interchangeable parts that were capable of generating individualized interpretations within the general semantic framework of the whole work. In this respect, we may wish to reassess our efforts to determine the one true and accurate interpretation of reuse and focus instead on the multiplicity of experiences generated by a single monument. Finally, it's also possible that for some, it was enough to simply identify these inscriptions as writings of an earlier era, which, like Kossuth's Rosetta Stone or Zhubing's Chinese characters, may have come to symbolize a distant past that we're able to recapture only in part or in ways that are only personally meaningful. And while I'm not about to suggest that we begin to think of Antoine Le Flamenc as a 14th century conceptual artist, I do think it's important to note that the existence of so many ready parallels between a Frankish Byzantine church in central Greece and the works of contemporary artists suggests that we should resist the urge to perceive our ancient forebears as less sophisticated in their reception of spolia simply because they could no longer read a Greek or Latin inscription. For if these works have taught us anything, it is that a lack of literal comprehension can sometimes inspire an even greater and more involved conversation. Thanks. That's what I got. Questions? Does it work? Or are you just going to say, well, walk away? Uh-oh.
I'm just curious, you mentioned at the end that the people who were using this church had been able to read the inscriptions, but I'm wondering if anybody would have been able to read them at that point? If there would have been a group of people who were literate and who would have had the education to be able to make sense of the blocks mentioned, that there had been some scratching out. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Possibly also people who are educated who might have been able to read the inscriptions. Would they have been maybe building this church in order to demonstrate some form of cosmopolitanism or something along those lines? Was this way of, you know, speaking of people being something that's rooted in place also being related to processes of mobility or travel?
So what we understand is if we pay attention to the kind of Byzantine manuscript tradition, the ability to read sort of majuscule Greek, sort of classical Greek in all capitals, the way it's presented in the inscriptions here, seems to have dropped out and seems to be limited to a very few who could still do it. The Byzantine Greek we have access to, it's much more cursive script, it's much more sort of just handwritten, and they're readily able to read those kind of things, but there's a sense that this information is lost to them. Now that doesn't rule out everybody, because there are a couple of examples of studies of churches where people say, wow, you know, the things being referred to in this inscription that's placed right by the doorway, you know, the main entrance into the church, there's so many local references here and it's placed right side up in the proper place. Somebody, you know, some academic from Athens or something like that, somebody must have been able, you know, the suggestion is often made, you know, the patron who has the leisure to actually study these kind of things as an antiquarian pursuit, would have understood that and would have seen personal connections between that. Now, does that require them to actually read the full inscription? Or is it enough that they pull out an essential 10 or 20 words that are personally meaningful for them and that help connect them to their place and to their past? That's kind of where we're up for grabs. Certainly the travel aspect is really interesting. We have a couple of examples of people in the 1400s and 1500s who are traveling through here and who are identifying and copying down inscriptions. So, but what's already starting to happen in that experience is that people are attempting to associate with an earlier past and not with the contemporary past. So it's an antiquarian pursuit. I'm copying down this earlier, more austere inscription from my study back home, not as a way to sort of engage with what's going on in this Byzantine church.
You know, so are you saying that already,
so
the news of your talk was also that Desari got very little of
that's right. I think, you know, kind of, yes, okay, but for local Byzantine Greeks who are living in the area, there seemed to be a much more sort of vibrant culture of developing stories around things that are either somewhat understood or not understood at all. But for people who are visiting from the outside and looking in, it's very much a thing where we're trying to get back to an earlier period of time than the unfortunate sort of local residents who occupy the place now. You know, so, yeah. I think over the years, the more I study Spolia, the more I'm just amazed at the power of a couple of paragraphs in Vasari to really shape what we do as students of reuse. The effect that he's had on, if you were to add up, you know, sort of just take a percentage of all of the works written on reuse and talk about the ones that the subset of those that specifically talk about the Arch of Constantine, they're just vastly out of proportion. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that that was his prime example. And so just under the influence of him, we just keep going back to this one monument and dealing with the debate. In some ways, he set the rules for the debate. Maybe not in a way that he intended, but it's phenomenal to me the ways in which we're still having his argument and not our own. Yeah. Yeah.
So this is all kind of new to me, but I'm wondering, if as I'm looking at these, can you separate out from these inscriptions what is a good stone that fits into this space versus, hey, this is a neat design, let's put this
right
in this place. I mean, I'm thinking about in Bloomington, Indiana, I lived in this farmhouse that had in its foundation an old tombstone that had still had, you know, part of its inscription in it, and it probably was fit the space. So is there a way to figure that out?
Let me see if I can go. So this has kind of formed the core of what I've been trying to do. Sorry if I'm giving people a headache. So for example here, you can't see it very well, but here is a right side up inscription. See if I can find another one for you. Some of them are upside down. This is an upside down one. Some of them are right side up, some of them are upside down. And what we've tended to fixate on in the past is, you know, is it legible? Can it be read? You know, and quite often what would also happen, I showed this picture, but this is from Sparta, but we know from the British archaeologists' day books that whenever they found an inscription, you see a little bit of one right here, whenever they found an inscription, they pulled it immediately out of its context and put it in the museum. And that's really unfortunate, because what you're suggesting is exactly where we should be, as we should understand its perfect context, you know. And because the idea the early studies of architectural reuse were just, don't worry about its secondary context, that's not as important. What working with spolia was supposed to do for you as an academic was supposed to show that you recognized the significance of this piece, even though it's in the wrong context. You understood it in its earlier iteration as something far more important. You read it for its inscription, you studied it, and then you forgot about the fact that it had a secondary context. So only recently have people started to sort of think about where exactly they were. And what I was doing in a lot of my work is saying, you know, I so much don't care about what the inscription says anymore. I'm interested in what the inscription tells me in terms of what the builder was thinking when they put it in place. And what I found in studying this wall is that actually if you study it closely enough, there are all kinds of inscriptions that can be seen in the seams of the blocks if you actually look into the wall. And this wall had been originally studied and suggested that it was one of the prime examples of how words had meaning and words were just decorative even if you couldn't read them. But when you actually look at it proportionally, there are as many blocks that are face in and sideways where you couldn't see the inscriptions as there are ones that are face out. And it seems to just, in this case then, inscriptions just seem to be incidental, that there's a second more important purpose, which is what you suggest, that this block fits very well right here. You know, and this block needs to be used this way, and whether or not it's inscribed is irrelevant. But I've also looked at other examples where the only time we see inscriptions is when the blocks have fallen out of the walls and they have cement still adhered to their inscribed surface that would suggest to us that they were face in and consistently face in. When you study spolia as meaningful reuse and you create this artificial subcategory, you never consider those examples, because those weren't meaningfully reused. But it turns out if you actually pay attention to all examples of reuse, you discover that there are certain places where they're being consciously rejected, where they're hiding all the examples of former use. And I think that's just as potent a sort of approach to the ancient world as the ones that recognize the inscriptions. Yeah.
Is this a wall near the big temple?
It is. It's the big temple with the one column is sort of up and a little bit to the right there. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah.
When you first said spolia, it was the first time I've ever even heard that word.
Yeah.
I looked up the definition of spolia and spoliation.
Huh?
When I looked up spolia, it basically had an exact definition of what you just described with the use of the stone.
Right.
When I looked up spoliation, it says something about reusing in an illegal or an unethical way. Is there any example
So the development of the word is really, really fascinating. It turns out that the word spolia comes to us from the Italian word that was invented in the 16th century by the sort of the group of Renaissance antiquarians and art historians who it was meant to designate a stone that was taken from somewhere and put in a new context. They hit on the word spolia because there actually is a Latin word spolium, and a spolium in Latin is the stuff that you take from somebody you've beaten. So if you strip the armor off of somebody, that is a spolium. And it doesn't have an architectural connotation in the Latin world or in the Roman world. That's a much later Italian thing. And what we think that the Italian sort of art historians and antiquarians were thinking was this idea of Christians, because they found most of the spolia they studied in churches. And it's the idea of the victorious Christianity stripping the spoils from the pagan temples and putting it into their churches as a sign of victory. And the word just kind of has always had those connotations. And what I've been trying to do in my own work is move away from the expression spolia and talk only about the process or the practice of spoliation to try and get rid of, it's the people who study this stuff have a real kind of love-hate relationship with the word. The word identifies what we study and what we do, but at the same time, it carries so much baggage that, you know, like the word pagan, you know, it carries so much baggage with it, but there is no better way that we know of to sort of readily and quickly define what it is we're studying. Did I? Yeah. Other questions? Okay. Thank you so much. What?
Yes, one more question.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just curious. So you're showing us buildings that have words on them, and I was curious about texts from the same time periods about architecture.
The word spolia.
Not in terms of the word spolia, but in terms of the edifices in general.
How people are talking about art. The problem is that then, in the classical and late classical world, writings on architecture were plentiful, but we don't have any of them anymore. The main work we have was written about, it's kind of neat, it's written about zero. You don't get to say that often, but it was written right at the change from the first BC into the first AD. And beyond that, we have a couple of military treatises that talk about how walls should be built. But that's more about how to plan them out and how to shape a tower. It's not about the, unfortunately, there's a very, very famous scholar who's said that, you know, basically spolia is a building practice that occurs in complete historical silence. And so what we have is, but now for me, I'm absolutely fascinated by that, because then really at some point, if we think of texts in the ancient world as aristocratic activity, reading and writing, and we talk about everything else as the stuff that archaeology is supposed to tell us about, you know, not having the texts is kind of neat at this moment. Because quite often in classical archaeology, if you have a text that says one thing and the archaeology says something else, you try and figure out what's wrong with the archaeology to agree with the text, because the classical text is the most important thing to always have be right, which is not a good working practice, but I don't have that added baggage of the classical texts that I have to wrestle with. I can actually just study this architecturally. And in some ways, you know, there are moments where I feel like we're really beginning to approach, you know, the lowest level of people, the lowest rung of Roman society, the sort of the common day builders. And what they're, I think the argument is kind of, you know, if you have a post-classical builder that is forced to pick up and evaluate a chunk of stone and think about how exactly he wants to use that in a wall, that's about one of the most immediate and direct connections with the classical world you could possibly hope for. And the evidence of what he did is still available to us today. It's not going to tell you everything, but it'll get you a lot closer to the sort of the ideas about the classical world that were held by common people than we typically can get. Thank you so much. Have a great night.